This is the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. This show examines the latest legal topics and news facing families whose loved ones have been injured in a nursing home. It is hosted by lawyers Rob Schenck and Will Smith of Schenck Smith LLC, a personal injury law firm based in Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to the show. Hello out there. Thanks for joining us. My name is Rob Schenck.
And I'm Will Smith.
I feel like you're just making fun of me just then.
I was.
It's kind of like when the Chicago Bulls are announced and come out and they come running out, high-fiving everybody. That's what we just did. That's my announcer voice. Anyway.
It's just like that.
Welcome to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. We're glad that you could join us. A lot of good things on the horizon today. We are going to be answering a question that we get a lot as nursing home abuse lawyers, and that is, how do the public, how does a person who has a loved one in a nursing home select and choose a nursing home abuse lawyer? How is that? What is a person looking for in an attorney?
Yeah.
And why choose one attorney over another attorney?
And understand that this is not an advertisement for our firm, because
no, we'll be speaking in generalities.
We you know, there are actually other firms who do exactly what we do that we have, you know, referred clients to for one reason or the other, either we're conflicted out or something. And so, you know, we know how to choose nursing home abuse lawyers because we also sometimes choose nursing home abuse lawyers.
That's right. So these are going to be just general points that you should consider. Don't take it to the bank, but just as something to think about if you have a loved one that has been injured at a nursing home or assisted living facility, and you're kind of doing that thing where you're looking at the buses that drive by and there's advertisements, or you're looking at daytime television and you see commercials for attorneys, or you're looking up at the billboards. Like, which one of those, if any, do you choose and why?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the first consideration that I think that you would want to make is, or at least the information that you want to saddle yourself with before making a selection, is that you want to select an attorney that has a practice that is not necessarily 100% focused on nursing home abuse and neglect, but at least has a high percentage of their practice dedicated to this. And there's a couple reasons why that is so. First, from a general standpoint, the law is very broad. And an attorney that does immigration law generally doesn't do DUI law or wills and estates, because immigration law requires a lot of time and a lot of experience to get right, to get correct, okay, and vice versa. So a law firm that handles business litigation, immigration, DUIs, and personal injury, I'm not saying that this is the case every time, because there are a lot of great attorneys that do a lot of different things, but as a whole, it's beneficial to pick an attorney that focuses in one area, because it allows that attorney to get more experience, more time, and keep up to date with the specificity or the specifics of nursing home abuse law.
I mean, if you think about it, it's the same thing. Imagine that you drove a Volkswagen. You know, which would you initially think would be better to take your Volkswagen to? A mechanic that only specialized in Volkswagen. We are the Volkswagen mechanics. We only fix Volkswagens. We only deal with Volkswagens. Or a garage that said, hey, we're mechanics, we're really good, but we do a lot of different types of cars.
Personally, exactly. And motorcycles.
And yeah, personally, I would take mine to the Volkswagen guys.
Right, so As a viewer or a listener, how would you know whether or not an attorney that you are talking to focuses predominantly in nursing home abuse and neglect? Number one is, if you're talking to them, ask them.
Yeah.
What percentage of your caseload is dedicated to nursing home abuse and neglect? But more often, you're kicking the tires before you talk to somebody, and you would do that through their website. If the website displays, you know, we do DUIs, estate planning, civil litigation, business litigation, you know, running the gamut, and personal injury, that's an indicator. If the site's, you know, only narrows it down to injury and then nursing home, that's another way. If the site just says we just do nursing home, that's another way. You can also use other methods of determining that. And one is the website, we always call it AVO. It might be AVO, I don't know, but it's AVVO.com. Yeah. And generally, most of the attorneys that have a profile, I think every attorney has a profile.
Every attorney has a profile, and it used to be that attorneys needed to claim their profile, but I think that now it's changed. But nevertheless, you can look up every doctor who it goes based on your license. If you're an attorney, you cannot hide the fact that you have an issued license by the state bar. So it does this for doctors as well. AVO does.
But when you go to the website, it will tell you.
Yeah.
What percentage of that person's practice is dedicated to whatever it is. So, again, the advantage to that of picking an attorney that focuses predominantly in nursing home abuse and neglect is that, one, they likely are more likely to have the requisite experience dealing with nursing homes. Mm-hmm. They are more likely to be up to date on the laws affecting nursing homes and nursing home abuse litigation. Number three, they're likely to have processes in place that expedite, effectuate, and resolve claims quicker than another attorney that has to basically learn the trade first.
And number four, in the world of, well, it's not just nursing home. I mean, honestly, these principles apply to picking an attorney in any specific area. It could be a criminal law area. It could be a contract area. In the arena of nursing home neglect, we see the same players on the defense side over and over and over again. The same law firms, the same attorneys, the same insurance companies. So if you get an attorney who only does one practice area, it is very likely and almost a guarantee that they will have worked with that nursing home, that nursing home's insurance company, and the law firm that represents both before. They have worked with them before.
That's right. And fifth advantage to picking an attorney that focuses in nursing home abuse and neglect is that they've learned the parlance. So, you know, somebody that does only trucking injuries might not know how a bed sore works, mm-hmm. or what the stages of a bed sore are. These type of things that are, you see, if you do these cases over and over again, the same concepts, the same injuries, the same missteps by nursing homes over and over again, you have an understanding of how these things shake out. So again, picking an attorney who focuses primarily in the area that you need is the number one consideration. And how you do that is investigation, either through asking the attorney him or herself, or going online to their website, looking and see how they advertise themselves. And three, you can go to other websites such as AVVO.com, AlphaVictorVictorOctober.com, and look and see how their practice is broken down on that website. The number two consideration when talking about
I would say that, because we talked about experience.
I would say that's number two.
Well, I also think that, like, that could be a subcategory of a practice area. Just because, you know, that's where their experience is going to be. But yeah, I guess.
Well, I mean, you could have somebody that focuses in nursing home abuse that opened last week.
That's true. That is a good point. Yeah.
So, experience. So, how do you know whether or not an attorney has experience? Number one, again, it's very easy. Ask them, how many cases have you had that are similar to mine? You can also look on the website. You can see, you know, whether or not they reveal recent settlements or recent verdicts. Those are really good indicators of whether or not this individual attorney has taken cases to court or settled cases that are similar to yours. A quick asterisk, a quick notation here is, and the question you might be wondering is, can I trust what is on the website? Yes and no. Number one is this. Lawyers, apart from other industries, are very, very highly regulated in terms of what they can do. You know, it doesn't seem like it because we're on buses everywhere. But attorneys can get in major trouble if they make misrepresentations in their advertising, which includes websites. So I'm not saying you can guarantee that if the website says we settled a case for $1 million, that that's not accurate, but they would get in major trouble if it was not accurate.
Absolutely.
Okay, so can you take it at face value? Maybe, but you know, or possibly, but anyway, if there's incentive to be accurate on the website, in other words, like whereas some herbal supplement has no incentive because they're probably not regulated by anything.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, the Food and Drug Administration.
Well,
and they have to put a asterisk at the bottom that says, you know,
this or whatever, is
neither or meant to heal or diagnose any disease
or laser tag.
Okay, I think a better one would be those editorial type fake news places that have no consequences versus regular journalists. Regular journalists are held to a certain standard and would lose all credibility, whereas those editorial type fake news sites that you see can literally say anything, like President Trump is from outer space, and there's no consequence. And what why we bring that up is attorneys are heavily regulated, like Rob said, by the bar. So an attorney placing an outright lie on their website is
this rare, probably.
It's very rare because it's not going to be there long before even one of their colleagues points it out and says, hey.
Yeah, and a really good point on how highly regulated we are as an industry is that at least in the state of Georgia, it's often advantageous for an attorney lawyers have to name themselves in a way that does not misrepresent who is in the firm. So, yes. For example, if your name is John Smith, you can be the law office of John Smith. You can be, if you have more than one office, the law offices of John Smith. What many attorneys have done in Georgia in the past, which no more, is they can say they are John Smith and Associates, where John Smith is the only attorney in the firm, and by associates, they mean maybe their staff. The Georgia Supreme Court has ruled that, no, sir. If it's only you, you can only be the law office of John Smith or John Smith firm. You cannot represent by saying an associates, because that is necessarily going to confuse people to think that you have more than one associate attorney at the firm. Same with group. Your John Smith is no longer allowed to say I'm a John Smith Law Group, because group necessarily means that you have more than one person providing legal representation. So that's how highly regulated attorney advertising is, at least in the state of Georgia.
We can't even say that we specialize in
Georgia
in nursing home neglect, because Georgia technically does not have a specialist designation. There are a few states that allow their attorneys to say that, because there is a specific specialization certificate that is issued. For example, in Georgia, there are some attorneys who are DUI certified, board certified DUI attorneys. But we, you know, that's just how highly regulated we are. And they can't necessarily say that they're specialized.
So at the end of the day, when you're trying to discover and unpack how much experience an attorney has, you can ask them, how many cases have you tried? How many cases have you litigated that are similar to mine? How many cases have you settled? How much have you settled them for? These type of things. You can look at their website, which is what we're saying is that more than likely you can trust what they're saying, because it's highly regulated, although sometimes there might be bad seeds out there.
Another way that you, and this leads into the third and final one, is meet with them and judge them based on their personality. How do they come across to you?
And you may be asking yourself, why does that matter? And being able to get along and having an appropriate method of communication with your attorney is going to be very important, because if a nursing home case goes to verdict, you're going to be with that attorney and talking to that attorney on a regular basis, and you're going to get to know each other very well, and they're going to get to know your family very well.
And you're going to be dealing with them for a long time. Because as we've said in previous podcasts, nursing home cases are not the type that you go to a lawyer and then a week or so later, you're getting a settlement offer. They can last, you know, 6, 7, 8 months to a year to 2 years to 3 years. So this is a person that you're going to be in a committed relationship with, that you're going to have to deal with all the time. You want somebody who connects with you on a personal level.
That's right. That you want somebody that doesn't make you feel like you're stupid. You want somebody
absolutely.
That, you want somebody that doesn't offend you. That you know a lot of times has your sensibilities.
That makes time for you.
That makes time for you and communicates with you whenever you can communicate. Some clients that we have only text. Some clients like email or what have you. But however the method that you communicate with your attorney, you know, you got to make sure that they're with it on that. Because at the end of the day, if it goes to verdict, and each case has to be prepared like it's going to go to verdict, is that the attorney has to be able to paint a picture of the life of your loved one. And that's going to mean getting to know your loved one, the good, the bad, the ugly, as well as the family. You're going to have to answer personal questions, because it's going to allow the attorney to make the argument in front of that jury eventually about who this person is, who their loved ones are, and that includes you. So if you can't get along with your attorney, then that's a non-starter. It's bad news. And just to put it in perspective, there, as it stands right now in 2017, there are over 1.2 million attorneys. So the odds of you through a modicum. I feel like it's modicum. Because if it's Latin, then it would be with an O, a strong O.
Mm-hmm.
So
is it monitor? Like my.
Is monitor Latin? So with a modicum of research, you can discover whether or not your attorney focuses in a practice area and has experience in that practice area. But only after sitting down and meeting with them will you probably be able to determine their personality and whether or not they fit with you. Because out of the 1.2 million attorneys, they're going to fit. You can find ones that fit in those three categories: the focus, experience, and personality. Because there's somebody out there. I would highly suggest that you don't settle on somebody just because they're close in proximity to you, just because maybe they called you back.
Modicum.
Oh, it sounds exactly like I said it.
No,
it
doesn't. Modicum.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the record, you can go back and replay it. Mm-mm. I said modicum.
It's not modicum.
Well, that's what that computer is saying.
No, it didn't.
Modicum.
Yeah.
That computer.
Modicum.
Yeah.
You went to a different one. Do it to the first one.
No, because that she doesn't make any sense.
Okay. Well, at least there is a dispute. But anyway, the chances of you being able to find an attorney that fits those three categories out of the 1.2 million is very good. So please don't stop searching. Until you find somebody that fits for you. That's what I would say. And I mean, and like Will said, I think it's the same as finding a mechanic. It's the same as finding, you know, the caterer for your wedding. You know, kick tires, ask around, see what's going on. And with that, let's move to an article that comes to us from
Maryland.
From Maryland.
Yeah. And this is one that happened, the article's from June of 2017. And this is, according to Maryland's Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, which I think is similar to Georgia's DCH, this nursing home was getting rid of many of its residents once their Medicare coverage ran out. Essentially, the facility would discharge them without their consent, putting them in homeless shelters or unlicensed facilities. And the reason that they did this was clearly to maximize their own payments from CMS and the state of Maryland itself.
That's hundreds of residents.
And that's, you know, I've talked about it before, this mentality of profits over patients. And that's what a lot of healthcare providers are doing nowadays. And it's important to understand what their mindset is, because there is a lot of talk right now, and there are some bills that are being passed and some that are surviving the House that have to do with decreasing the consequences and the liability of portions of the healthcare industry, including and especially nursing homes. And it's very clear that, you know, and this is just one example of one nursing home in Maryland that was egregious enough that this local newspaper decided to run an article on it, and we ended up with the article. But this happens all over the country, is that what is most important to this corporation that owns this nursing home is that they maximize profits. Now, with a typical corporation, that's exactly what the corporation's goal is. You know, if you are on the board of directors, your sole obligation is to the investors of that corporation, is to make sure that the corporation is turning a profit. As a nursing home, you know, as an LLC that owns a nursing home, personally, I believe that you have a moral obligation, and I don't know anyone who would publicly disagree with this. You have a moral obligation to take care of these nursing home residents. Now, if a resident, and understand something here, that I'm a capitalist and I believe in capitalism, if a resident is unable to pay and they have exhausted the coverage benefits of CMS, either Medicare or Medicaid or both, that doesn't mean that you are forced to just take a loss and continue to provide care for them. That's not the situation here in Maryland, though, and in other situations where this happens. They were taking these people in and, you know, sucking them dry of all the money, and the second that CMS benefit ran out, they weren't notifying the families. They weren't waiting for their consent. They weren't going through any sort of procedure other than, hey, listen, no more Medicare, Medicaid. Here's your papers. Get out. Dump you in a homeless shelter. You know, put you off into this other facility which has no license. Getting rid of them as soon as possible. And at least in the state of Georgia, where we practice, and I'm not sure about the rest of the country, but you're a resident of a nursing home. So that means that you live there, okay? You're not just passing by. You're not in a superstore picking up a box of chocolates. This is your home. So in order for the nursing home to evict you, even if it has grounds to, it has to go through a process. It's got to notify the family. It's got to give you, you know, the right to appeal. It has to follow a certain procedure before it can just kick you to the streets. And they weren't doing that at all. They were taking these people in. They were getting all the money that they could from them, and then immediately dumping them, quite literally, into homeless shelters and unlicensed facilities.
That's right. To reiterate your point, this article uses the term evicting, because that's exactly what it is. That's a residence and that they have to be evicted from. And so with eviction comes the concept of due process, and they failed that here. And as a consequence, the United States Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services informed the facility that it would be dropped from the Medicare program because it was not in substantial compliance with federal regulations. So they're losing their funding.
So that essentially, effectively shuts that place down. And a question you may have then is, well, doesn't that effectively evict all the residents? Yeah, but they're not being dumped into a homeless shelter or an unlicensed facility. Mm-hmm. What happens when CMS says, hey, you're not getting any more money, is that the vast majority of the time, the facility is going to have to shut down but they're also going to have to transfer all of those residents, work with the family, work with the residents, work with the physicians, and transfer all of those residents to an appropriate nursing home, not a homeless shelter and not an unlicensed facility. It's just a death sentence for that corporation that's just about to lose, you know, millions of dollars a year. But it happens.
Yeah. And moving to the story coming out of New York, Kingston, New York.
Yes.
Jack Stanley, former employee of Northeast Center for Special Care in New York, is facing 8 to 25 years in prison for sexually abusing six residents who were recovering from traumatic brain injuries. At jury trial, Stanley was convicted of a first-degree criminal sex act, 7 counts of first-degree sexual abuse, and 16 lesser charges. Prosecutors said between July 2014 and February 2015, Stanley used his position to gain access to residents and forcibly perform oral sex and other acts. He even abused one resident while the resident slept. The issue, the reason why I bring this up, bring this article to your attention, is to answer the question, what is the liability of a nursing home when an employee commits sex acts on the residents?
Yeah. And the answer to that is a lot of issues similar to this have to do with foreseeability. Did they know that this guy had a proclivity, propensity to do this type of thing? Should they have known? Did they know or should they have known? Should they have known that this was possible to happen?
And that type of information can be acquired by, number one, background checks when the employee was hired. So, for example, does the individual have a record? Has the individual worked in other nursing homes? And if so, were there any allegations or proven claims of sexual misconduct? And then, of course, if this individual, if they knew that about it previously and he did it again, that would also can be considered constructive knowledge. So these are all things that that the nursing home can do to acquire the knowledge that they need in order to be to take preventative actions to prevent this guy from doing it, and then of course be held liable for it.
And a lot of times it is amazingly simple to find information about somebody. I was speaking with a colleague the other day who is suing Uber for something an Uber driver did, and she was telling me that she literally Googled this guy's name and found 16 different felonies with his booking photo on Google. That easy. So it's actually atrocious sometimes how lazy these corporations are in researching their individual employees. But at least in a case of nursing home with CNAs, with LPNs, with RNs, these are all licensed individuals who have to go through a background check. I had to go through a background check as a CNA. If I had done something, you know, while I was a CNA, if I had been, you know, busted for some sort of certain offenses, I would have had reported that to the DCH that regulates my license. So all this information's out there. Then the question might be, well, what if this guy got away with previous incidences and the nursing home ran a background check on him and he didn't, and they didn't find anything, and they wouldn't have because there was nothing in the record? Then it's still a possibility. I mean, they're not completely alleviated of any liability. This still has to do with the circumstances there. You know, was he doing anything strange or inappropriate in these residents'
rooms?
Were
there complaints from the residents?
Were there complaints? Did they notice different behavior from the residents? So there's a host of possibilities that could find them being liable.
That's right. And with regard to background checks,
this is going to be interesting.
Yeah. If you have done any research at all on this podcast, you would realize that generally the content is contained to within 30 minutes.
Oh.
And so we have...
It's a good segue.
Thank you. And so we have, in fact, reached the end of this particular episode of the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Mm-hmm. You can watch new episodes every Monday morning. You can do it in two different ways. Mm-hmm. Number one, you can download the audio.
Or MP3
on Stitcher or iTunes Radio or wherever you download your podcasts. You can also watch. We encourage you to watch. Because we think that that's could be a lot. It's a lot funner to see.
It's a lot more fun.
It's a lot funner to see me sweating under these lights.
Yeah.
And you can do that at our website, which is nursinghomeabusepodcast.com, or on our YouTube channel.
Yeah. So it is definitely a lot more fun.
A lot more fun. So with that, we thank you for joining us, and we will see you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and feel free to leave us some feedback. And for more information about the topics discussed in this episode, check out the show website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. That's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.